Okay, I'm back at the festival and it's day 3 and I've got an artist here called Benji Reed, who I've known for many, many years. And Benji's been kind enough to spend a little time with us and tell us a little bit about his career. And I'm all going to start with that opening question of, why did you come into theatre? Why did you pick mime?
Well, to tell you the truth, ever since I've seen Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot, I was completely blown away by his performance. Especially when I found out that, obviously, you know, he wasn't suffering from multiple sclerosis. I can't remember. Cerebral palsy, sorry. I was just blown away by his physicality, and I wanted to do something of a similar vein. And after leaving dance school, I got a job as a performer working on The Tempest. Mm-hmm. And I played Ferdinand, the lead character. And that was my first source of... My first attempt at theatre. I don't think I did Shakespeare particularly well, but it allowed me to kind of get used to the sound of my own voice in a different way from just kind of performing as a dancer on stage. And it kind of opened up a lot of opportunities. But I'd been a fan of Black Mime for a very, very long time. And I was just finding a way in which I could kind of be part of that group. But before that, I ended up working with a guy called David Glass, and he had a mime ensemble. I worked on this piece called Bozo's Dead, and I had no text in it at all. But again, all of the work that I did with David over the year that I was working with him, he started to show me all the techniques of mime, some techniques of physical theatre, some clowning skills, and he started to open up the world performing for me. So not only was it coupled with the ballet and contemporary that I had and the body popping, but now I'm actually getting mime underneath my belt, and right. That really was something that was really important because they're so similar, body popping and mime.
But it's funny because you want to tell your stories through physicality. What happened to just straightforward, boring acting? You know, getting on stage, standing there, waving your arms and speaking.
You mean being a talking head? Basically, because I'm not that style of performer. It's not to say that I can't do it. It's just that it's not something that I'm engaged with as a performer. And I think whenever you work as an artist, if you're not engaged with the art form, if it isn't something that's drawing yourself to it, then eventually that art form will kill you because you're literally selling your soul. And, you know, I find that when I perform on stage that this is part of my spirituality. Yeah. You know, so therefore I'm not for hire in that sort of sense. Okay. Or I can't do work by an author that I don't believe the words to.
Okay. I mean, there's a lot of people actually who basically think you're fantastic in the work that you do, and you really have specialised in the world of mime. I remember going back, this is going back a long time now, Benji, you know, I think 1980s, I spotted you in, what was it, Black Mime?
Yeah.
And I was blown away by some of the stuff that was being presented. You know, how did you get involved in that? Why did it sadly come to an end?
Yeah, it was early 92. Okay.
Was it the 90s?
Yeah, it was very early 90s. How I got involved was, again, there was a show called Superheroes that was just amazing by the three performers in Black Mime when they were the male ensemble. And it was directed by Denise Wong. And I'd written to her and I'd begged to be in a company for 2 years. And eventually she gave me an audition and I got into the company. And what was the second question you asked, sorry?
Why did you get involved in it? And also, why did it come to an end?
Yeah, the reason why I got involved was because it was telling my story, but in a very unique way, in a very innovative way, that there wasn't any black mime artists out there. Never mind, you know, this mixed ensemble that's doing stuff about real issues in black people's lives. So that was the reason why I got involved, because I felt as if that was part of my story. I was part of this legacy that, one, I was allowed to tell my stories, and two, as a physical theatre performer, this was taking me on a journey.
But you were also breaking down barriers. I mean, you were doing extraordinary things. I mean, on stage, you know, I think there was one, I can't remember what the show was, I just think all the guys turned into women. What is going on here?
This is really
weird. It's all playing your mother and stuff like that.
You know.
But it was brave and it was breathtaking and quite challenging.
Yeah, and you've got to put that down to Denise Wong.
Yeah.
Denise Wong, you know, was the very clear captain of Black Mime in the latter years. She knew where she wanted to steer the performers, and she also knew by us always playing different. genders, that we were challenging the audience. We were challenging the people that was going, like, men should be men and women should be men. And it's not to say that ain't true or isn't true. It's going, we're going to challenge you anyway. We're going to challenge you anyway. Your perception of what this performer can do will change by the end of the night. But not only that,
and also the black stereotype.
That's right.
As well, that's why I thought it was groundbreaking.
Yeah,
because some of the messages that were coming out were just like extraordinary.
Yeah,
and I have to be honest with you. I mean, I got a bit upset actually because it all came to an end. And
yeah,
Denise Wong seemed to part company with you guys, and she was pushing you, and I could just really, really see that breaking the boundaries. You were telling these fantastic stories, and then it just stopped.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, because there was a massive call of black companies around that period. You know, it wasn't only just Black Mime, there was Double Edge Theatre, there was The Base, you know, and I'm sure you can name a myriad of...
Phoenix Dance, they were kicking off at that point as well,
remember? Yeah.
They were doing amazing things on stage.
Yeah. So, you know, there was a number of companies around that period that were getting called, but also as well, if I'm going to be really honest, was that the work had stopped being progressive. It had become stagnant. And, you know, every 3 or 4 or 7 years, you need to rejuvenate yourself, you need to find something new, you need to find a new way of saying something, you know, you need to find a way of reinventing yourself. And if you don't constantly reinvent the wheel within your own company, eventually that wheel becomes very rickety.
So what happened to you then? Because then you left, didn't you?
Yeah.
So tell us the story.
Again, I was reinventing. You know, I met up with John ZD.
Okay.
And then we kind of became the pioneers of hip-hop theatre in the whole UK. And, you know, we then toured over to America. One of my first shows was in Sydney Opera House, you know. And, you know, I just ended up doing world tours with my own solo show. But basically working with John ZD, he was an MC, choreographer. I'm a body popper, actor. Both bring them both together, you get hip-hop theatre. And, you know, again, it was like people going, my God, that's brand new. I haven't seen nothing like that before, you know. And that was a challenge, you know, was to go, you know what, this stuff is going to be so new that everyone's going to want a piece of it. And that's what happened. And it's got to the point now, as a performer, you know, almost 10 years down the line, where I'm going, I'm not sure I want to do hip hop theatre anymore.
It's quite interesting though, so just talk about the relationship with you and John ZD. I mean, probably two of the nicest guys in the business, seriously.
Right.
How on earth do you manage to work with each other? Because, I mean, you are both really, really brilliant guys.
Yeah.
Must have been pretty competitive.
It was very competitive, absolutely. And that was the reason why we made the work the way it was that, you know, there would be a point of going, yeah, well, that idea is good. And like, yeah, but look at this. And like, oh, no. Oh, that is so sick. Oh, no. Think about this. If you do it that way, like, oh, no. That's it. We're going to kill it. And, you know, that was that great thing right at the very beginning where you're just going, you know, and there was a competitiveness, but it was about driving the engine. It was about driving the wheels of like two pistons going.
It's a bit like, I mean, I know it sounds a bit boring. It's like Lennon and McCartney. They actually competed against each other, but they raised the standard to such an extent.
That's right.
That it was breaking, you know, boundaries. It was amazing.
And, you know, in the beginning, it was electrifying to see people's faces as we're performing in this very small theatre in Albany. Yes, that's right.
Tell us about that.
Okay, well, I'm the original director of that first piece. John Z came to me and says, oh, look, I've got an idea and I want to start exploring it. And I started to pull the piece out. And I says, well, you know, there's characters here that you can actually break out and start playing that character there. And, you know, you can actually use this poem and actually really bring it alive and actually make it kind of a live theatre piece, in a sense, you know. And, you know, we took it to one level, and then John Z went, you know what, all of these places that the characters go in, there's actually a national dance for that. Let's put in the dances. So once the dance came in, then the whole form started to come together. So not only was John Z physicalizing his poetry, but also then finding the dance moves, and then all of a sudden the language of hip-hop theater is starting to form, because out of this poem it's kind of telling you the kind of parameters of what this language could be. So then we started to make work within that kind of ilk.
Okay.
You know, so went on to do Silence the Bitchin', which was, again, it was a battle rap that would be then kind of physicalize every single word. And kind of, it was very visceral in terms of the way that we'd pull out words and twist it, and the way that we'd contort it and kind of use body popping to kind of illustrate the language, the written language.
Mm. I'm really proud about you, because you seem to do things that, you know, we talk about theatre, traditional theatre, mm-hmm. and the audiences that come to shows. And we know that the majority of them are middle class and white. not with your audience.
No.
That's the beauty about the work that you do. You actually reach out to places that many artists can't reach out to.
Yeah.
You know, the black youth, which is, I take my hat off, and I think that's fantastic.
Thank you.
Why do you think that is important?
I think that it's important that when you have a demographic, that you have somebody that you're aiming to speak to. And of course, I'm going to want to speak to young men, because a lot of young men are lost right now. And a lot of young men would like to find another way forward. And sometimes theatre can help. And my only thing is that if I tell something from my heart and it's truthful, it has resonance. Mm. And that resonance then goes on to allow people to then go and do different work or become directors or become actors or become writers because they're inspired. And being somebody that can inspire, because I've been inspired, it means I'm continuing the legacy. So that's what's really important. That's why it's important to kind of try and reach out to a younger demographic. But it isn't the holy grail it isn't the only thing I want.
I know.
You know, I want a broad audience. I want people of my age also to come and see the work. I don't want it to be ageist. And I don't want to be that guy that's always capped with having to kind of get the kids in.
Yeah.
You know, as an artist, I am making more challenging work, and I'm going to be making more challenging work. And some of it might not necessarily be appropriate for young people.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, it's you and John Z, and you're both sparring off of each other.
Yeah.
What happened then?
I needed to find my own voice. I needed.
So you kicked him out?
No, not at all.
He kicked you out?
No, not at all. I wouldn't, you know what? Even if there was any darkness, it's never ever going to be over the airwaves. So allow it. No, I needed to find my own voice, and it just came to a point where I needed to find out what Benji Reed thought of the world. What were my politics? What did I understand about the world I live in? And the first piece that I did was called Paper Jackets.
Okay.
And it was a man that was trying to find his way. He worked in a fan factory in the basement. He was a nerd. And he wanted to be something. So he tried to work his way up the ladder of this business. It's all about office politics. And basically, he's been completely ridiculed. He's been completely his hopes are totally misguided until the point where he loses the plot.
Right.
And he ends up burning down the building.
Okay.
He doesn't kill anyone, he just ends up burning down the building. Okay. But the story is narrated by this slightly autistic boy of seven. So there's two people that are playing the story. I was playing the main character, Cypher Blackman, and then the younger character, which I forgot his name now. But it was a kind of a physical two-hander that I was playing as a solo show. And again, it was about me. How far could I stretch my storytelling skills?
Okay.
How much could I bring from Black Mind into this?
Yeah.
How much could I bring from working with John Z into this?
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of going, you know, how else do I tell stories? And that was my kind of first step out there into kind of going, you know, what am I as a solo performer?
Because you are known as a performer, but come on, you're also known as a director.
Yeah.
And a very good one too.
Yeah.
Where did that come? How did that come about?
Well, Denise Wong was the first person that pushed everybody in the company to kind of direct. That was one of her orders in the company. You know, it's not just about it being an order. It was something that she wanted to implant in us, that we had visions too, and we were allowed to exercise them.
Okay.
So within Black Mind, I was already starting to do a lot of directing.
Okay.
And also she allowed me to be the leading artist on her summer schools. So by the time I'm coming to work with John Z, I've had bags of experience in terms of kind of going, I know what looks good. I know what works really well there. Mm. That really works. And, you know, I started to cut my teeth working with John Z as well.
Yeah.
You know, so they were just kind of the small baby steps, because for me, I think they're all baby steps. Because, you know, I've directed a show at the National Theatre.
Yeah, I know.
You know,
I'm going to come to that.
Sorry, I'm jumping ahead of myself. But yeah, so how I got into directing was basically through Black Mind.
All right, okay. Okay, I saw a production, I think it was Charlie Dark, at Birmingham Rep.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
Right, I've Box Will Travel.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
You directed that, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Again, I think that was really fun, because you're working with somebody that is a so-called non-actor.
Yeah.
Yeah? But a great performer, a great writer. And, you know, he's quite multi-talented. You know, he's a DJ, you know. He writes great stories. You know, he's got his own running club. You know, Charlie's just so amazing in what he does with all of his talents. And I wanted to tell a really truthful story about his life.
I mean, what was interesting about that is that it's the audience, because the audience, again, they were very middle class, very white, but they loved it.
Yeah.
They were just like, wow. I mean, it was quite an interesting period, because I was looking around and you had the black youth there who would buy into that.
Yeah.
And then you had the middle class who was sort of like, what is all this about? And then actually warming to it and realising that actually it spoke to them.
Yeah.
And that, you know, this is as much to do with them as it is to do with...
Exactly.
With the black youth.
Was that
a deliberate ploy?
Yes, definitely. It's authentic and it's a rite.
Universal.
And it's a rite of passage.
Yeah.
And from once you're warm to the central character, you can't but help get swept away with it. As long as you warm to him. Because then you kind of go, well, actually, I go through this as well. Mm. Regardless of whether you're a street sweeper or whether you're some high executive, there's always things that kind of block you in your life's path. But they're there to test us.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things was that it was a universal story. One, that it was very funny and it was warm. And that Charlie got to do him. Mm. You know, I wanted him to make work on... I actually wanted to make him to make the beats on stage. I wanted him to play every single song that you heard.
So funny. I mean, it's just heartwarming, because it was just nice to see this guy. What was it? Was it spoken word? The genre.
I don't know what you would really call it, because in one sense Charlie does a spoken word delivery, but I think because it's kind of housed in a narrative, then it kind of slightly broader than spoken word. And I think that's what's really beautiful, is that a lot of the work I do kind of straddles a lot of these genres. It's never kind of one foot totally in one camp. It flirts with these genres. Yeah. So there is spoken word, but there's also storytelling. Then he's also a DJ, and he's also making the beats on stage. And also he's a comedian, and also he's using physical theatre, you know, physical comedy. Mm. So he's using all of these languages. And one thing I think about my work now is I'm understanding that I'm very eclectic,
like how hip-hop started,
pulling from here because it works, and pulling that from here, and then finding a cohesive landscape in which it works.
Well, what's remarkable, and you're talking about, this is a one-man show, literally a guy on stage with a couple of decks, and, you know, he's got to fill that stage, and he's got to fill that space for 1 hour.
Yeah.
I mean, that's asking a lot, and to pull that off, which he did...
Yeah.
It's remarkable. There isn't, you know, the traditional backdrop and set and this, that and the other.
Yeah.
It was just him.
Yeah. But I think that's one reason why when certain people approach me to make work, I go, I can make work with you, because you've got a life worth of stories, you know, to tell. You know, you've been to the mountaintop and come back down. You've got enough stories, enough life experience to be really engaging. And there's other artists that ask me to make work on them. I go, at the moment, you're not there yet. You know, not everybody can do a solo show, especially in their early 20s.
Yeah, why?
Because sometimes they just don't either have the emotional experience.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't... they just don't have the experience that life sometimes...
Fill that space.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you do it then?
I didn't do solos in my 20s. I did solos in my 30s. So I'd worked with a number of companies.
And it takes a lot of confidence.
Yeah,
it
certainly does. And
a hell of a lot of confidence.
Yeah. I'm always nervous before I go on stage. And even sometimes days before, I'm nervous.
Right.
As soon as I get on stage and something clicks, then I go, right, I'm there to tell the story.
Well, we're going to talk about that. Not right now.
Okay.
Because I want to search your brain around the National Theatre. What happened with that show? Tell me about it.
Okay. I was approached by Tom Morris... to do an experiment in the National Theatre, and I go, okay, I'll do something. I want to do Clockwork Orange. I really want to mess with it. I want to mess with this classic, and I'm going to change up all the characters. I'm going to put a girl in there. I'm going to get rid of the Nadsa, and I'm going to put poetry in there. And I want to do it my way. So I made this piece that was, the first half was really, really strong, and the second half sucked. It wasn't so strong. I presented it on the national stage, and 900 tickets sold out in 2 hours.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
which theatre was it?
Cotslow.
Okay.
What's apparently the fastest selling ever.
Right.
So that's pretty big.
It is pretty big.
You know what I mean?
What did you do with Clockwork Orange?
Well, what happened is that I was waiting for Nick Heitner, Wicked, now I get to speak on this. Because Nick Heitner said that he was going to, you know, speak to me about the piece. And I really needed help, you know, as a, even though I'm an old person, I'm a young director. And
you're not that old.
Well, 43.
Okay.
yeah, kind of. You're over the hill, sir. No, so basically I was waiting for Nick Heitner to get back to me. Because I didn't mind that they didn't accept it, but I really wanted him to say, look, yeah, these are the things you really needed to look at, you know, and help me look at my work. And I expected that of the artistic director of the National Theatre. It's the National Theatre. It's our property too. And what happened is that basically he never got back to me.
Okay.
And we tried and tried and tried. And I just thought, you know what? I don't mind you inviting me into your building. And I don't mind doing a show, but at least have the courtesy to get back to me and tell me. If it's rubbish, then tell me it's rubbish. So I can grow as an artist. So I felt a little bit, slightly bitter about that experience, because it meant that we invested so much as a company into making that production that we couldn't afford to tour it alone. So that production never ended up touring in the end because we couldn't afford to do it on that scale.
Okay.
So that's what happened to Clockwork.
Okay, that's a little sad, actually. One of the things that strikes me about you is that you actually go out of your way to support a lot of up-and-coming artists, don't you?
Yeah. We've got this program called Process 06, Process 08, and we try and get as many young artists into the theatres in and around Manchester, and I bring international artists to come and work with them solely for 2 weeks. My thing is about how do we kind of disseminate this information, our information that we have as artists, how do we do it in a really creative, beautiful environment where we don't have to kind of create a show at the end of it. Because sometimes I find when I work with a kid,
it's not about the end product. It's about the development.
It's about the
experience. Yeah. Okay. It's almost like a license to fail. It's about the individual. You've got time to grow.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Yeah. And that's really was the premise, because, you know, there's one point in kind of going out there sailing. Oh yeah, I'm Benji Reed. I'm breaking cycles and we're doing shows. And then there's another part that goes, what's the other arm of that? If you're out there selling shows and selling awares, there has to be something where you're giving back. And you're nurturing the soil, you know. So that was my whole thing, was just to kind of find a way in which I could, one, make work, and two, build new audiences, and three, kind of get young audiences to kind of see how work is being made. Because lots of people come up to me after they see a solo show and go, I want to make a solo show. Mm. And I'm like, bruv, you're not ready yet.
Okay.
You really need to join an ensemble. You really need to understand how to act.
One of the things I actually adore about you is the honesty. I mean, it's just, you just seem such an honest individual. Mm. We're here at Decibel. Why are you here? You don't need to pitch your work. Surely you're respected. Everybody knows you.
Yeah.
And everybody likes Benji Reed.
Well. It's debatable. I think that you always have to keep on working. You always have to keep on working.
Why?
Because I think that the minute you rest on your laurels, one, you become complacent, and people do forget. 4 years is a long time as a soloist not going out on the road, and there's been lots of great work that's been out there in that 4 year period. So you need to remind people that you're still about, and remind them that you're ready to do the footwork.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of wherever I've been, I still need to do the footwork in
and
order to
sell your show as well.
That's
and
right.
Do you think that this is a great opportunity?
It's an absolutely great opportunity to, you know, you've got 100 odd delegates, if not more, here. That you have a chance just to meet and greet, and even if they don't buy the show first, 300 delegates
for a whole week. Yeah,
you know, that's a lot of people. Yeah. So you know, it's about being able to kind of at least have some conversation with some of these people and plant the seeds. Mm-hmm. Even if it isn't for this show, it's about all the future shows. It's about your strategy.
Do you think that it's a bit of a shame? Like, for instance, we don't have a huge black presence in the Edinburgh Fringe.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there?
I just think that a lot of black artists can't afford it. Is the reality. You know, it's like, yeah, I want to be at the Fringe too, but I can't really afford to fail right now because we don't have that much money. Okay. And, you know, that's where I think it is. I think it's an economical thing. I don't think it's a cultural banishment thing. I think it's all about economics. Mm. Because when you're looking at taking a show to Edinburgh, you know, it's a huge gamble. And a lot of people, even from my position, and I'm pretty well funded, won't gamble like that. Because if you lose, you can lose pretty big time.
It's horrendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very, very sad. Internationally known festival and has very little black presence.
Yeah. But then you could also say that about the Manchester International Festival as well.
Yeah.
That's the same thing that you know, again, the presence of I won't say necessarily black people, but Manchester artists is very low on their agenda as well. And, you know, but I actually like that. I like when it's very clear that you're not going to go through that door, or that door there is kind of closed to you. Because it allows you to start making your own doors.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah, okay. But and it's interesting because Decibel seems to fit brilliantly in Manchester. It's the second time it's here.
It's more than the second time. I mean, Decibel was the home. Manchester was the home of Decibel for at least 3 years, and then it went to Birmingham and it's come back to Manchester.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's great because Manchester's got a great theatre community.
Yeah, I know, it has. Yeah.
It's got a great
and great nightlife, as I know. As I'm still trying to recover from last night, but anyways, it's not about me. It's not about me. Okay, so you're here pitching your work, and what is that? What is it that you're pitching?
I'm pitching the new show called The Devil Has Quintin's Heart, written by Ray Shell, myself, and a guy, and directed by Peder Kirk.
And why are you doing this? Why this particular show?
Oh, yeah, because I love Ray Shell's writing. I think it's absolutely amazing. Iced is one of the greatest books I've ever read. You know, it's it came out in 92, and it chronicles the story of a down-and-out crack addict who kind of wanders the streets of New York and Baltimore and God knows how many other places, and it's just kind of this horrible, desperate story of a crack addict, but it's so beautifully written, right. And it's so full of pathos and power, and I wanted to do that story.
And you're performing in it.
The show that I'm doing is a meditation on Ice. In other words, it's an adaptation of one of the characters in Ice. It's not the main character.
Okay. So what happens in your show then?
I don't want to tell you. I want you to come and see it.
And when do we get the opportunity to see it?
Look on the Breaking Cycles website.
Okay.
Breakingcycles.co.uk.
Okay.
And you can get all the dates on there.
Okay. And at least tell us when. When?
Oh, it's going to be this autumn.
Oh, all right. That's fantastic. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And what's happened to your knee?
Yeah. I twisted my knee and then found out I got arthritis.
That must have been a bit of a shock considering that you rely so much on your body.
Yeah, it was. But then I'm just getting into this point where if I couldn't walk, I'd have still have done the show. I'd have done it in a wheelchair.
Really?
Yeah. And also, when my leg started to recover, I really understood what it was to walk again.
Okay.
I was crawling around in my house for 3 days, could not walk.
Really?
You know, and to be able to walk again just made me realise how precious my body is.
Yeah.
And just how precious the time that I have walking is. So I'm trying to do as much as I can with the body, but also I'm looking after it. I'm using my technique more.
Right.
You know, so my past training is really coming in handy now, because all the ballet and contemporary training now is very much is what I use now about alignment.
Right. We're going to end this interview.
Great.
I want to end this interview on one thing before you get to go away. What? I can't get over this. You're shy.
Yeah. I know. Ridiculously, chronically so.
And yet, when you get on stage, you are phenomenal.
Yeah. But that's the flip side of the coin. Yeah.
The Jekyll and the Hyde.
Yeah.
And I watched you do your pitch, and it was just this shy individual who doesn't want to talk, but yet has so much to say.
Yeah. Do you know what? I hate it.
How do you get over your shyness?
I don't know. I know that I have to keep doing it, but it's chronic. I have chronic shyness. I mean, I really find it even hard to network, but I'm doing it more now. I'm doing it more. And I think it's just because I think as a kid, I got shot down quite a lot. So I didn't want to kind of raise my head above the parapet. I didn't want to be the one to be shot down. So sometimes it was easier to be kind of quiet in the corner with a glass of wine rather than being so big. You know, like when I start dancing, I'm a different animal, but yeah, I hide behind
well,
myself.
Don't
sometimes.
Hide too much. Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
I love the work that you've been doing, and you've got to keep doing it.
Thank you.
I hope that your new show is going to be huge. I'm sure it's going to be very, very
thank
successful.
Thank you very much,
Benji. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.